Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, who's a professor of law at Syracuse University and president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an educational organization with 4,200 members, a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. He wrote the best-selling books Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. He has an article at Tax Notes, Tax Havens Let Billions Vanish into Thin Air, and another at Salon.com, LAPD's Indefensible Dauner Pursuit. Let's start with the tax havens let billions vanish into thin air. How many states are involved in losing money? I take California is at the top of the list.
Yes, it is. All of the states allow these rules, as of course does Congress, under which corporations earn profits in, let's say, California, but they turn them into tax-deductible expenses and move the profits to places like the Cayman Islands and Bermuda.
So what kind of loss does the state of California incur? Because it's, you know, just today, Moody's didn't upgrade the state, but said that it was actually getting better, but it's still downgraded. And it's only one notch up from the state of Illinois in terms of being at the bottom of the barrel.
Right. Well, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group's Education Fund did a study, and its analysis was that California loses about $7.1 billion. Can you hold on a second? I want to get rid of that noise in the background.
Yeah, it sounds like the cook is throwing saucepans. Anyway, I'm talking here with David K. Johnston, New York Times veteran, Pulitzer Prize winner, the author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And we're talking about his article at Tax Notes. Okay, go ahead, David.
It's about $7.15 billion in California. That money comes in large part in California from corporations, more than $4.2 billion. That may seem like a very big number in California. It's about 40% of what corporations pay the state. But remember, California is home to companies like Google, which is very well known for its offshore tax strategies. It's home to the movie industry, and the movie industry has become particularly adept at earning money offshore and keeping it offshore. So that isn't particularly surprising. And then for individuals, the estimate was around $2.9 billion a year that individuals move out of the state into tax havens.
Well, you know, the state of Texas is saying, you know, come to Texas. You know, California is going to tax you. And, you know, the city of Los Angeles is thinking of having an extra sales tax as well. And, you know, the state of California introduced one to fix this, the decaying education system here.
And if you want to have an even worse education system, go to Texas. Texas has one of the worst education systems in the country. Last year, they cut an additional $5 billion out of their education system. And here's how much regard the current governor of Texas has for education. Back in 2004, he wanted to lower the taxes on mansions and wealthy people's homes. And instead of shifting that off onto poor people, he was going to make it up by having video lottery terminals installed at the gas pumps. So where you're gassing up your pickup truck, you know, you can gamble. And by charging, putting a tax on topless bars, which sort of gives a whole new meaning to politics and mother's milk.
So, David K. Johnston, what is the likelihood, though, of any of the big moguls? We're talking about corporate taxes, but right. I can't imagine Silicon Valley moving to Dallas.
Well, there is. Remember, one of the original big companies in this business was Texas Instruments. They continue to be there. You will see lots of operations probably moved out of California. There's a lot of work being done now in, for example, Idaho. Hewlett-Packard had big operations up in Idaho and to Texas. Corporations are going to go wherever they think they will get the lowest return or alternatively the biggest subsidy that they can get people to go. If they're jobs that involve a lot of talent, then they're in a little different spot than if they're a commodity job. If they're talent jobs, you know, a few years ago, Google's Motorola Mobility Division got a huge subsidy from the state of Illinois by threatening to move to rural Iowa. Well, there's no possibility that they would do that. The engineers and research scientists who live outside Chicago and who want its cultural amenities and big sports teams, they're not going to go to rural Iowa. But nonetheless, it got the state to give them, if I recall, $122 million in subsidies, and that's one of the biggest games these companies play. It's to get money out of the taxpayers. What's new, what this new PIRG study showed, and both the piece I wrote for State Tax Notes, which is free online at taxanalyst.com, and I rewrote it just about California for the Sacramento Bee over the weekend, is this idea of how much it's costing not Washington, but Albany and Sacramento and Springfield to have these offshore tax havens.
So just to finish up with this subject, because I want to talk about the LAPD. Obviously, it's a big subject here, and we just had another shootout, car chase, carjacking here in the Southland. The why do these wealthy and profitable companies, why are they haggling over what's really small change to them? The state needs them, the money badly. What's the problem?
I think, Ian, we've seen a complete breakdown at the very top of any sense of the social compact. I can remember when I was a young reporter, stories in the late 60s and early 70s about a company having to lay somebody off, and the president, we call them CEOs back then, we called them presidents, the president of the company would say that he was going to not take any pay raise or only work for his salary, no bonus or anything extra, until every one of those people were hired back. Now, CEOs practically dance up and down. Oh, boy, I get to fire more people and I'll make more money. And there's been a real serious breakdown. And it's because instead of thinking about the welfare of the whole society, we've created this society where at the very top, all of the social benefits and rewards that come to you depend on how many commas and how many zeros come after your net worth at the end of your net worth statement.
So again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnson, who is the president of the Investigative Reporters and Editors, an educational organization with 4,200 members. He's a 13-year veteran of the New York Times and won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting uncovering loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he's the author of his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Now, turning to your article at Salon.com, LAPD's Indefensible Dawn of Pursuit, was so much the subtext of the Dorner pursuit here in Los Angeles was that Dorner tried in his manifesto to suggest that the LAPD was still this racist organization that it was under Daryl Gates, and you reported then for the LA Times about it. But on the other hand, in Dorner's own manifesto, he gives a shout out to these racist disc jockeys here, Ken and John, I think they're called. And a guy called Bill Handel saying, "Keep it up, guys." So he was, ideologically all over the place. But nevertheless, a lot of people in the minority communities, particularly those that experienced police abuse over the decades, some of them were prepared to believe that this guy was a victim. So it put the police chief on the spot, and seemed to be going out of his way to say, "No, we're not the LAPD of the Daryl Gates years."
Well, I think what this case shows is things haven't changed that much. Clearly, Dorner became deranged about what he was doing. That doesn't mean that things that he spoke about in his manifesto may or may not be true. But I think the important issue in this hunt for Dorner was how the police acted in two shootings, the one by the LAPD down in Torrance and then moments later by the Torrance PD. The LAPD, which I spent 3 years covering in 1980-83, I was the first mainstream journalist to seriously take apart and examine and document how the LAPD was operating, including all of the massive political spying and the brutality and whatnot. has written policies and training about shooting. You are not allowed to shoot at a moving vehicle, even if the vehicle itself is being pushed toward you, or being driven towards you, except under very limited circumstances. And what happened here? Well, we've all seen the picture of that blue pickup truck with, it looks to me like at least 20 bullet holes in the back of that truck. The LA Times interviewed a man who had 5 bullet holes in his door, so there was a fusillade of weapons. Well, the pickup truck with these 2 Hispanic women in it doesn't even look like Dorner's truck. It's a bright blue Toyota pickup, and the truck Dorner was in was a gray Nissan. Minutes later, a surfer, a slight white male who looks nothing like Dorner, in a black Honda Ridgeline pickup. And anybody who's listening, if you don't know how different that looks from a Nissan, just go to the internet and put in Honda Ridgeline. It's a very distinctive, I would say ugly, but a very distinctive truck. They rammed it with their car, and they shot into this car. This was completely out of control, and there is no possible way that you can fit the shooting by the LAPD officers into the LAPD's training and policies. It's not within a mile of those policies. And yet what did Chief Beck do? He immediately moved to excuse this away, saying these officers were under tremendous pressure. That's absurd. And it is totally inexcusable, but it signaled to people down the stream in the police department how they were to deal with this shooting, that the chief had said, well, figure out a way to excuse away what happened here.
Well, at the time, he had to answer some of those questions. He did an exclusive interview with the local CBS Channel 2 reporter here, Pat Harvey, and he used that occasion, of course, to say to Dorner via television, look, we're going to revisit your case and rehear it. And it turned out, subsequent to that, there's been some reporting on exactly what the LAPD's review process is like, and it is definitely stacked against the complainant.
Oh, yes, it is. And the LAPD isn't unusual with that. It was very interesting that when Chief Beck did that, and I was pretty transparently, an effort to get to Dorner, assuming he's going to hear this message in the news, to try and get him to ease off in some way and say, we're listening to you. You'll also notice that former Chief Bratton immediately gave an interview that poo-pooed that and undercut whatever Beck had done in an effort to get to him. But, I think this is a really important issue here, Ian, that there is a fundamental legal policy. A police officer does not have the right to kill you as an innocent person in order to protect himself. Now, back in 1982, I think it was, it may have been in 81, I was asked by Daryl Gates to go take the police department's shooting course up at the police academy. They have a large room where there's a huge aluminum screen instead of the kind of white screen you see at a movie theater. It's actually bent a little bit. And they play a movie. They give you a 38. You put on a Sam Brown. You get a 38 with plastic bullets. And the computer records exactly what frame was showing when you shot the gun and where your gun hit. I didn't have any advance notice of what's in this film, although I of course, figured most police officers did, and they showed a film in which an actual incident happened. 2 cops on foot patrol in L.A. walk past a bar. There's a commotion. They turn around. Bandits come out of the door of the bar. There's a woman pushing a pram with a baby in it and another innocent civilian. I allowed in the camera, this fictional episode here, my partner to get shot to death. And then I proceeded to shoot and kill both suspects. I got an almost perfect score. Put my gun back in the holster, turned around, the lights came up, and up above me was a television camera crew from the LAPD and still photographers. And I realized that what Daryl Gates had done had hoped that I would stupidly, wildly shoot my gun and on film kill the innocent person. They didn't know that I had used and owned guns and whatnot. But the lesson in that was, and I talked with the police department about it afterward at length, was about, well, sometimes your duty as a police officer is to die. That's a terrible thing, but you don't kill innocent people to save yourself. And that's exactly what the Tacoma, the shooting of the Toyota Tacoma is about. It was officers afraid Dorner was in that truck and shooting without knowing who was in it because they valued their lives more than what turns out to be innocent civilians. That's criminal conduct. That needs to be seriously addressed and not, as Chief Beck has indicated, explained away.
Well, I think they were shooting. They weren't probably so much in their own lives were threatened so much as they were supposedly protecting residents where a high-ranking police officer.
Ian, that's going to be exactly that. That's going to be their justification for it and the excuse for it. But in the piece that I wrote for Salon, which is also at Alternet, there are links to the actual PD policy. You can read the LAPD's policies. And that shooting, yes, they were trying to protect people who were clearly targeted, and they should be doing that, or they should have people to defend them. These were two Hispanic women in a vehicle that doesn't look at all like Dorner's, delivering newspapers. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there was
a policy at all.
Sure, and they were very lucky to escape that fusillade of bullets. They could have been.
Oh, absolutely. One of the two women was struck, the other wasn't at all. And that goes to another point, by the way, that every study I've ever read of police shootings, even when there's very close-range combat, nearly all bullets miss. People are in a state of absolute terror. They're not. This is not the fictional Clint Eastwood characters where people are perfectly cool. And the slightest uncertainty and motion in your hand with a short-barreled gun causes bullets to go all over. There were bullets in trees and mailboxes and garage doors all over the place in this shootout, which I think is just absolutely indefensible. And people in L.A. should recognize that this is a real warning sign about the actual culture of the LAPD, not its written policy, not what the law says, but the actual on-the-streets policy. And that's why I did this piece, because it does show that 30 years later, after all these scandals, all these things that have come out since I did the groundbreaking work back in the early 80s, it hasn't changed very much.
Well, just back to the police chief Beck's appeal to Dorner to come in and they'd review his case. Obviously, it didn't work, but another deputy died, and another one was badly wounded. What did you make then of the use of the tear gas, which caught the place on fire? Is that a big deal?
First of all, let me be real clear. I don't give any quarter here to Dorner. What he did was criminal. It's outrageous. The police had to find him. That doesn't mean that they had to execute him. And now you get to this question of he's in this cabin that he took some people hostage, and he said he wasn't going to hurt us. He didn't have any beef with us. So the guy wasn't mad dog out of control. He was focused on what he was doing, and clearly awful. I mean, he didn't go kill the captain he felt had wronged him. He killed the captain's daughter and fiance so the captain would spend the rest of his life feeling awful. I mean, that's pretty monstrous conduct. The tactics that were used once they had him in the building, what's the rush? If you know he's in this building and he's surrounded, what's the rush? And if you think there are innocent people inside whose lives are at risk, why would you fire tear gas canisters in a way that would lead to this fire? Why wouldn't you go in there? Oh, that would mean putting officers' lives at risk. You decide to become a police officer, you are making decisions, and if you volunteer for the kind of assignment like going into that building, they're not going to order people in that kind of a situation. They're going to take volunteers. Yeah, you may get shot or killed.
Right.
Police work, however, remember, is not that dangerous. There were a total, in recent years, there's been between 45 and 70 police officers a year killed in the line of duty by assailants. The death rate for fishermen, that's a death rate of about 1 per 100,000 police officers. The death rate, 10 per 100,000 for police officers. The death rate for fishermen is 260 per 100,000. You're vastly more likely to die on the job if you are a carpenter working on the roofs of buildings than if you're a police officer.
Well, David, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnson, who is the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an educational organization with 4,200 members. He's a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he is the author of a couple of bestsellers, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. And his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. He has an article at Tax Notes and the Sacramento Bee, Tax Havens Let Billions Vanish into Thin Air, and another at Salon.com, LAPD's Indefensible Dawn of Pursuit. And this is Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. The rest of the program is available at ianmasters.com. The interview on the Chinese militaries, how autonomous they are from the Politburo, a very interesting subject to cover. So that's available at ianmasters.com in about an hour from now. We are in our first day of a new fund drive, and today we are offering up we've done two-thirds of a program, which we're going to attempt to do throughout this fund drive. So we're giving, you know, the idea is to, the reason you support us is you like the programs. Well, then we give you as much of the programs as we can. And so we're doing much, much more programming and much less fundraising on the basis that that you would appreciate that. And in this last 15 or 20 minutes, we're offering up a great premium, something that is right in the news. In fact, the Academy nominations were just the deadline to vote was yesterday. So on Sunday, we'll be having the Academy Awards. And we've had here in the studio just recently the filmmakers of one of the feature documentaries that's up for the Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary, Five Broken Cameras. We are now able to offer that film up to you as a premium here in exchange for a $100 donation to KPFK at 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. That is the number to call to get this brand new DVD of a documentary that's up for this year's Academy Award. It's called Five Broken Cameras. The five broken cameras are the five cameras that this Palestinian farmer, a non-professional who taught himself how to use a camera, he decided to document his life as Israeli settlements encroached across from Israel towards him and started to swallow up his land. And he and his neighbors engaged in very creative, non-violent protest. The film is done in conjunction with an Israeli filmmaker, Guy Davidi. It was actually shown, financed by Israeli television, shown on Israeli television, although as a documentary, didn't get a lot of play. Presumably, if it gets the Academy Award, we'll get more so. But it's a film, really, that I think the American audience, more than anything, needs to see. It's such an extraordinary revelation about all this agony that we've been hearing about for so long between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And it's pretty no secret that most of America's politicians and the press in this country are extremely one-sided in believing that Israel is the victim and the Palestinians and the Arabs are out to kill all the Jews. But this film does give you an extremely different perspective. It's a very, very powerful piece of work. Again, the Academy Award nominated documentary feature, Five Broken Cameras, for a $100 donation here to Background Briefing. Alan Minsky has joined me, the program director here. Alan.
Yes, and I think what is incredibly exciting about getting this now as a way to support KPFK is here and here alone, will you get the DVD, will you get Ian's interview with the filmmaker?
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.